As it follows from the title of this talk, it would be a little bit, how to say, diversion from the main topic of this meeting, although it's not totally unrelated. And I will I would like to talk about about deformation of homoclinic and periodic solution of a system that undergoes singular perturbation. In the process, it will be it will be clear how it is related to the problems of perturbing various evolution equations. For example, the model that I will be talking here is related to the perturbation of the KdV Kartsev de Vries equation. So, but my talk is not in terms of underlying theory of traveling waves, but rather in the realm of perturbation theory for ordinary differential equations itself. So the model examples in the literature there can be found there can be found a number of model examples. For example, some of them are given here. Well, the classical work in this direction was perhaps was the work of Kraskal and Sigur of 1991, but in fact it was done much earlier, which talked about the singular perturbation of this equation. It was the equation of simple crystal growth, they called it. And so by singular perturbation, I mean when the equation is perturbed with higher derivative with a small parameter, or a number of higher derivative with corresponding small parameters. So I will so these three models and their various perturbations were discussed in the literature quite extensively, and I will focus on this equation and various perturbations of this equation. So what perturbations I have in mind? Well, I will again in this talk I will mention three of them. So the first one is this perturbation. Here D is a standard differential operator, so the perturbation term is really this one, and so it turns this second order equation into the fourth order equation. And the question is, what will happen with various solution of this, or let's use dynamical jargon and call it trajectories of this equation under this perturbation. The other type of perturbation that can be treated in a similar way would be the case B, which is just a discretization. It's a corresponding Euler scheme, if you want, for this differential equation. And the third type is a little bit requires a little bit more fantasy, and actually it's the same as A, but some extra terms were added in the right hand side, and I will briefly tell what could be the effect of this extra term. That is actually something that we are currently considering with Dmitry to understand better what's going on there. Essentially I will focus on this perturbation on this model with some notes about B and C. And also there is a question which of the solutions of this equation we want to trace under perturbation. The more or less classical, well, of course I shouldn't use the word classical, but the standard approach in this exponential beyond all order business is to consider what happens with a homoclinic solution, so heteroclinic or some sort of separatrix solution. And I will be talking mostly of that, but I will also mention how one can treat the case of perturbation of other solutions, which will be periodic solution to this equation. So that's our outline. And I would like to go slowly, if I can, and discuss the problem with, of course, avoiding all technicalities, but with some essential details. So first of all, let me now mention that this model A can be obtained by this singularly perturbed fifth KdV equation if we just consider a traveling wave frame reference and perform one integration. Then, after proper scaling, we will get exactly the model A that I mentioned. So let's go into a little bit details and consider the phase portrait of this equation. Well, this equation, of course, has a constant of motion, which is treated as energy given here, and therefore, if we plot this energy function as function of y, and then we can draw the phase portrait of the equation, and you see that it will have a hyperbolic stationary point at the origin, and there are two solutions, unstable solutions going out, and two stable solutions getting in, and there will be also periodic solutions, right? So considering this, for example, considering this periodic solution with a fixed energy. So it's a fixed energy. If we fix this constant E, there will be two curves corresponding to the periodic solution, and we're talking about two branches of solution if one likes to work with real time. And correspondingly, we talk with two branches of the separatrix solution. But if one doesn't mind to work with complex time, then it can be treated as once as the same solution, as we will see from the next slide. So this, let me give expression for this solution. So Hamiltonian solution, a separatrix solution, is given by Sech square with a negative coefficient. That is that solution. Or if one likes the other branch, which actually I like, then it will be sinh, 3/2 divided by sine hyperbolic square. So that's the second solution. And if one wants to consider the periodic solution, then it's given by the Weierstrass function. Okay, now as I mentioned before, I like complex time. And if one would like to consider the complex time, then one can see these different branches of the Hamiltonian solution as just one function, say 3/2 sinh square x over 2. So if we fix our variable x to be real, so we are on the real axis, then that is just this function, and so the corresponding trajectory would be, we start from zero, going somewhere to infinity, which corresponds to the pole at the origin, and then go back from infinity to zero. That is for positive axis. However, if we want to stay on this side of the phase portrait, then all we need to do, we need just to move up to move to the distance I pi in the complex plane and go along this green line, then we will get the second expression for the second solution from the previous slide. Okay, that's just simple part. I would like to mention the corresponding things happening for the periodic solution. Then we will have, instead of the hyperbolic function, then we'll have this Weierstrass function. With if we take a constant, you remember there was this potential well, and if we take constant energy, constant E of this level, then we will have two periods of the Weierstrass function, one to be real and the other one purely imaginary. And therefore, if this is a quarter of the period of the Weierstrass function, so if we go along the, as you know, Weierstrass function has the pole at the origin. So if we go along the real axis, we will be going, we will recover this part of the trajectory. And if we go along the, over here, along this horizontal line, then we will be oscillating on this part of the trajectory. And, well, so with this, and here I would like to mention that, of course, if we allow one of this periods or half periods of the Weierstrass function, of course, completely define it, and if we allow one of them, say, omega real period to go to infinity, then we get to the hyperbolic case, and we are approaching the separatrix solution, and if we allow the other period to go to infinity, the vertical one, then we're getting to the bottom of the well, and that is the trigonometric solution. Okay, the next slide I would like to mention. So now let's consider the standard perturbation approach applied to our problem. And I will show, again, that is, as it is well known now, that for such singularly perturbed problem, standard perturbation approach doesn't work. So we are looking, actually, the first question that is posed is whether this separatrix solution of the previous slide can survive a singular perturbation. So whether for small epsilon we can have solution which approaches zero at both plus and minus infinity and doesn't have singularities anywhere in the middle along the real axis. We are talking about the real axis. And we can show that. So let's do naive perturbation approach. So I would like to solve the solution in powers of epsilon rather than in powers of epsilon square, which I can do. To do this quite easily, I can introduce a new variable, which will be a new variable called p, which will be just 1 over sinh square of x over 2. And then in order to plug it into the equation, I need to develop the rules of differentiation for this variable and for powers of it. Well, simple computation show that this is a rule of differentiation. So now I can plug everything into the equation, and simple algebra shows that we can construct a formal solution of this type, where p capital sub k is a polynomial of p small. Note that p small is a even function, so solution which approaches zero at plus and minus infinity, so we get a desired solution. Well, you can object that, well, there is a singularity here, but again, if we move over I pi in the complex plane, then sinh will become cosh, sinh square becomes cosh square, and everything will be fine. The only problem with the series is that it's not clear whether it is convergent or not. And so, of course, this is a series of two variables, epsilon and p. So when we talk about convergence, one has to specify what range of all variables involved. So clearly, with respect to epsilon, we want epsilon to approach zero. So it's a small positive epsilon. What about with respect to p? Well, as you see, p is... If we go from the real axis r to this I pi over 2, then the meaning of p will be like 1 over cosine hyperbolic square. So really we're interested in p within the interval from 0 to 1. And it's absolutely not clear whether this series is converging, even for small epsilon and p on the interval from 0 to 1. And moreover, from what follows, it will be clear that this series cannot converge on for this intervals of p. So the series is formal. The first proof that this equation doesn't have has no homoclinic solution was obtained by Emick and McLeod in 1990. But their method is really very much geared to a particular equation. So therefore, I get interested in I get interested in the approach of Kraskal and Sigur that seem to be applicable to much wider class of equation, and that's what I will be talking about. Well, also, what is the explanation that that we have this series, and it seems that in every power of epsilon, we have each additional small correction is even and decays at plus and minus infinity. So how comes that the solution is that there is no homoclinic solution? Well, the explanation is that the phenomenon that we are really looking for is exponentially small in epsilon. So it should be like something like constant times e to the minus another constant times epsilon, where k is a positive constant. And therefore, no wonder we cannot catch it with any power of, no matter how small power of epsilon. Now, after working on this problem, I well, all publications on this problem were mostly in applied or physical literature, and where people again mostly work on the formal level, not formal level in the sense that I presented before, but also something of in the sense that I will talk about, but still it is a formal level. So I would suggest a three-step approach to this sort of problem. So how to deal with this type of problem if we want to go beyond all powers of epsilon, if we want to catch exponentially small terms. So these three steps are proper rescaling of the problem, so we'll rescale of the problem, so the leading order terms would be different now from what they were before. Secondly, we will have equation with a small parameter epsilon, because we cannot eliminate it completely. So we will do the leading order analysis after rescaling, where the difference between behavior at plus and minus infinity will be visible already in the first term. In the leading term, we can see it. And secondly, which the part which is completely absent in all applied works is how would you prove that the solution of the full system, of the full rescale system, converges to the leading order rescale system. This rescale system is often called inner equation, as opposed to the original, for those of you who know this jargon, as opposed to the original equation, which is called outer equation. Right? So the convergence of full inner equation to the leading order equation is the most difficult part of, and the most technical part of this process. Now, why did I choose as a basic solution 1 over Sinch hyperbolic and not 1 over Kosh hyperbolic? Because the idea behind it is that the exponentially small phenomena is better visible in the point where solution is large, and where solution is large, near singularity. So therefore I put singularity into zero for convenience. So this singularity, in a way, serves as a sort of a microscope where we can catch the difference between solution. So this is how we will start. We will start with one solution decaying at plus infinity, the other solution decaying at minus infinity, and continue along them to the point, to the origin. And at the origin, these two solutions either match each other or mismatch. So because the origin is chosen to be the pole, we can easily see, it is easier to see whether they match or mismatch each other. So again, this is why the pole serves as a sort of a microscope. Okay, so the first, in order to use, if you want this microscope, we do the first step, which is a proper scaling. In this case, I change variables, independent variable, x equals EZ and y equals V over epsilon square, and this is epsilon Z, excuse me, so that the epsilon drift from being in front of the force derivative to here, right? So this is what is called the inner equation. And the leading order inner equation, you just drop this epsilon from here, so that is the leading order inner equation. So my claim is that already in the leading order inner equation, we can see the difference between behavior at plus infinity, of course in variable z now, and behavior at minus infinity. Well, but before we get to more precise formulation of that, let's understand what type of solutions of this inner equation, what type of solutions of this equation we're looking for. So if we take solution y of x, and that's of original equation, and do this rescaling, let's take the leading term only. I took here a formal solution, and let's take only the leading term. Then, taking in account this change of variables, the leading term will look like that. Right, and if we now compute the limit as epsilon goes to zero, we will get this term, 6 over z square. So therefore, still on the formal level, our assumption or our direction of the search is that we are looking for solutions of this equation with this behavior as z goes to infinity. Now, there is no small parameter epsilon, we eliminate it, so there is only one variable z. And we are looking for solutions of this equation that behaves like 6 over z square at plus infinity and at minus infinity. Now, so here is the, so this is the now this is the rigorous posing of the problem. And the answer to this problem is given by the theorem that was in my paper of 993, that such solution V of Z does not exist. And I would like to sketch present a sketch of the proof, which is not that technical, but somewhat illustrative of what's going on in this theory. So first of all, so there will be several steps. First of all, we'll try to satisfy this equation with a series in inverse powers of z square, and we can do that, and we can construct this series, right? Which is called formal series because we really don't know whether it has zero radius of convergence or non-zero radius of convergence. By the way, I use the word divergent series to emphasize if the series has zero radius of convergence. So it's purely formal. Okay. So I would like to, although it's not obvious, but easy calculations show that this series is sign alternating. Coefficients are real and sign alternating. It will be important. Now, the next statement is that if the series is divergent, that's equivalent to our statement. Why it is so? In one direction, it's clear, because if our statement is that there is no such solution, then this series cannot be convergent. That will be contradiction. So that direction is clear. So we really think about the other direction. If the series is divergent, then our statement, then there is no such solution. And to work out, of course, that is non-trivial part, and to work it out, I would apply the inverse Laplace transform to this series. Well, actually, I cannot inverse Laplace transform we can apply only to functions. So I can claim that I apply this inverse Laplace transform term-wise, or nowadays in the literature there is a special name for such transform, which is called the Borel transform. That's exactly inverse Laplace transform applied term-wise. So if I apply But I would want to apply also inverse Laplace transform to the equation itself, shown here. And if I do so, the equation, you know, differentiation comes to the multiplication, and the multiplication comes to the convolution. So I will get this nonlinear convolution equation. Convolution comes because of nonlinearity. Well, and although it's not a differential equation anymore, it doesn't make it much better. However, there is a theorem, again proven in the same work that I mentioned before, which essentially says the following: this convolution equation has a solution V of t that is analytic at the origin. Right? In other words, if you apply inverse Laplace transform to each term of the series, essentially you divide by factorial it and change variable z to dual variable, which is called p in this case, the new series will have positive radius of convergence. That's equivalent to this statement. Now, the only possible singularities are at the points plus minus I, plus minus 2i, and so on. How can we see that? Well, even if we start to solve it by iteration, you will have to divide, so you solve it for V of p in the left-hand side, you will have to divide by p square plus 1. And that is where these singularities come from. Of course, you can say, well, there should be singularity of at 0 coming from this term, but there is some work to show that this is not the case. There will be no singularity at 0. And the third statement is that, moreover, solution has such behavior in the p-axis, or in more general, in the complex p-plane, that the Laplace transform exists. And then the Laplace transform is our solution. Right? So that is the non-trivial part of this proof, which, again, very technical, but I am not going into that. So taking this into account, I would like to make another simple point, namely saying that if V of t, so V of t may or may not have singularities at the point plus minus I, plus minus 2i, and so on. So what I am saying, if V of t has a singularity, then the corresponding series V hat is divergent. Why is that? Because if V hat will be a convergent series means certain rate of growth of coefficients, and then if you do the inverse Laplace transform, then this function V of t will be entire. We can just estimate coefficients. It's very easy. When you do inverse Laplace transform, you divide by factorials. If something that grows as a power, say n, say some constant n to the power k, is divided by factorial k factorial, then clearly what you get is entire. And these are the coefficients. That's the entire function. Now, so what remains, taking into account this statement, what remains to prove is that there is a singularity, at least one singularity, and we are done. Because if the series is convergent, then there should be no singularity. How do we prove that there is a singularity? Well, this function V of t has Taylor expansion at zero, of such form where A is a coefficient of the formal series we had. Now, I mentioned before that there is a sign alternation in this coefficient. This is positive, that is negative, this is positive, that is negative, and so on. So if we go, because the singularity is the point I, so we want to go from 0 to I along the vertical, on the vertical axis. And so therefore, on this segment from 0 to I, because of this property, minus I times V of t will be positive. It's easy calculation show that this function, V of t multiplied by minus I, is positive on this segment. And therefore, if we look at this, so let's look at this convolution equation. Suppose that we have no singularity. Then at the point I, this left-hand side should be zero because of this factor. But let's look at the right-hand side. If there is no singularity, these elements of this convolution, both are positive. So this integral cannot be zero. So we get a contradiction, and therefore there is a proof that it has a singularity. And so we prove that and so we completed the proof of the theorem. Now, how this theorem helped us in terms of, well, essentially what we proved that there is no, that the leading order equation has no solution that goes to zero at plus and minus infinity simultaneously. Okay, what is it, nevertheless, what is the difference between these two solutions? So suppose one goes to zero at plus infinity, the other goes at zero at minus infinity. Although I haven't said that there are, let me say something about this solution. So, okay, so now let's look at this. This is a complex p-plane, and now we suppose we know this function v capital of p that I was talking about. So how to get this solution that goes to zero at plus infinity and minus infinity? Very easy. We just need to take Laplace transform. That is, integrate from zero to infinity, and we get solution v plus that has that behaves like 1 over z squared at plus infinity. If we want to have corresponding solution at minus infinity, all we need to do is to integrate in the opposite direction. And then we'll get the second solution. Moreover, each of the solution v plus has asymptotic expansion like 1 over z squared and other terms in that wide sector and of the complex plane and v minus in that wide sector. So what is the difference? You see that there is a region, for example, up here, there is a region where these two asymptotics overlap. So the two functions have the same asymptotics, but they are different. We just proved that. So question is, what is the difference? And of course, difference, as you know, would be, or can guess, would be exponentially small. Well, how can we see that the difference is exponentially small? Well, for example, we can deform. So if we take the difference between v plus minus v minus, that means from this contour we subtract that contour. That means that we integrate along the real axis. And then we can bend this integral. As there are no singularity, we can bend it either this way or this way, whatever we want. And let's work out one of those integrals. Suppose we bend it down, so we are so then we can claim that the main contribution in this integral comes from singularity near this point. And so if we work out this singularity, and actually we can prove that this singularity has this form, where c is a certain constant, which is actually has a name of Stokes constant. Right, that's and k is some power that we don't know beforehand, but we can compute it. In this case, in the case of this equation, k is 1. So if we replace this integral and we compute residue around this point, that is a contribution from the first singularity. There is as you know, there is a second singularity and the point 2i, 3i, and this singularity are not necessarily poles. They may have some logarithmic part and whatever. So roughly speaking, it's not correct to take only pole contribution, but I'm talking about the first pole, so it doesn't really, first singularity, so it doesn't really matter. So if we do the simple calculation, we will recover this leading term, z to the power k minus 1 factorial, e to the iz. Now, if you recall that z is in fact x over epsilon, and we are interested in x with imaginary part greater than zero, because remember, really what we are interested when we're talking about homoclinic solution, it was on the level I pi x, right? So imaginary part of x was pi. So therefore, we see that we get exponentially small difference between solution coming from plus infinity or minus infinity, or as if you want to use dynamical language, between stable and unstable manifolds. Right, in this case we have this exponentially small difference. Now the most that was the second part of 3-point plan that I showed you. Now the third one is of course convergence, and that is, as I said, the most difficult part. So here is the situation. This is our full equation, and this is our truncated equation. And we know that in the case of positive epsilon, we know that there is a one-dimensional stable and one-dimensional unstable manifold near this hyperbolic point, origin is a hyperbolic fixed point. And so, so we need to show that indeed solutions, indeed this stable solutions that correspond to the stable and unstable manifold converge to the considered above solutions V plus and V minus as epsilon goes to zero. Again, that's the most difficult part, and as far as I know, it was not proven in any of the papers that that discuss this asymptotics beyond all order. So here is the theorem that that deals with this equation. So let me point to the main difficulty in the problem. The main difficulty is that the behavior of solution of let's refer to it as a, I can refer to it now as unperturbed equation and perturbed equation. So the main difficulty is that solution that we are looking for of unperturbed equation is of the order, algebraic order, 1 over z square, whereas solution of the perturbed equation that corresponds to this stable and unstable solution is of exponential order, because in the leading order it behaves like 1 over sinh square of epsilon z. So the difficulty is to match, to somehow treat or measureize or to build an iteration procedure that will take care of simultaneously exponential behavior and algebraic behavior. Well, so the natural and the relation between this exponential and algebraic behavior is clear from this expression. If you take limit as epsilon goes to zero, you will get 6 over z squared, so you will get algebraic term. So therefore, I thought it is natural to linearize the problem around this function, which I called 6 q squared, where q is 1 over sinh, or 1 over sinh epsilon z over 2. So that will cover simultaneously both cases of epsilon equals 0 and positive epsilon. Well, of course, I wouldn't go into details of the proof of this theorem, which is very technical. But basically, the theorem says that the solution to the full equation, which corresponds to the stable solution, say, uniformly approach solution of the limiting equation V plus in the region of this shape, where here we have a cut of a finite size. This note that epsilon goes to zero, this region becomes wider, right? And so I have to be exact, what do I mean uniformly convergent, but that can be taken care of. Essentially, still there is a little technical difficulties because this is autonomous equation. So even if I talk about a stable solution, I can shift it. There is allowed time shift. So I work, so this problem is taken care of by requiring that at this point, our solution of the derivative of the solution, the derivative of the solution of the full problem is zero. So it's if you think about this solution that goes this way, so the time is the direction is wrong. So the time is set this way, that at t equal at, well, its time is x. X equals zero, we are at that point. Derivative is zero. Okay, so that takes care about, so that completes the proof that we indeed have a splitting of the solution. And in fact, we can do something more than that. We can compute the any splitting characteristics that we want, angle, distance, or whatever, by analyzing these iterations or some number of leading terms, we can do very, very, very good job. Now, here are a few comments about other equations. So let me talk a little bit about the second equation, about third equation. So that was the equation that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. If I do the rescaling and completely the same transformation as I did for the main equation example, then I will end up with equation of such form. And again, the leading order in an equation will have this form. Well, I strongly believe that although I haven't checked it, but I'm absolutely certain that the theorem from the last slide about that the perturbed solution approaches the unperturbed solution in the limit when epsilon goes to zero will work in this case the same way as it worked in the previous one. Yes. I'm not sure if it's coming from KdV hierarchy, but what I know is that this equation was mentioned many times in the papers, in the many papers of Alan Chapness and his co-authors, and they did extensive numerical study of. So their question was under what condition on. Well, they considered actually full equation. They didn't consider leading order equation. But the question was under what condition on mu, or in more general setting, under what condition between parameters of this equation, there are homoclinic, or there are what they called solitary wave solution of various types, of this type, of Mohams and so on and so forth. And so their numerics, if I translate it into the language of this leading order equation, their numerics indicate that there is an increasing sequence of values of this parameter mu where we should have solution with algebraic decay on both plus and minus infinity simultaneously. Well, in one case, for example, first mu is 5 over 4. And that is very easy if we just plug the very first term 6 over x squared into this equation. You will see that it will produce terms of order x to the minus 4. That is this and that one, and they cancel each other. And it produces terms of the order x minus 6. This one and all terms from here. So if you just choose this coefficient correctly, they will match, and that is a solution. Recently, as I mentioned, we are discussing with Dmitry this problem, and recently we get a proof that there are any other rational solutions that satisfies this equation. Actually, the proof is very easy, but I don't think I have time to talk about that. It is absolutely clear that if there is a solution that decays simultaneously to plus and minus algebraic decay at plus and minus infinity, then the corresponding Stokes phenomena should be trivial. That means that the constant, what I call Stokes constant before, should become zero. So, and that's very difficult to trace because Stokes constant is known to be a transcendental quantity. There is no any procedure to calculate it. So that's what we are looking. Now I would like to mention is there was also the discretized equation, and more or less literally what I said before for singularly perturbed equation can be performed for discretized equation as well, and we can show that there are no separatrix solution after the discretization that was done in my paper of year 2000 and something. And finally, this is the last slide, and I think I'm running actually ahead of time. That's very good. But I have one more slide about deformation of periodic solutions. So in this case, a situation is a little bit more different from the homoclinic or heteroclinic situation. And the reason is that when we perturbed, so here is the picture, right, and here is the periodic solution. So when we perturbed the homoclinic solution, we still know what we are looking for. We're looking for solution that goes to zero at x going to minus infinity, right? If we're talking about this solution, or at plus infinity if we're talking about that solution. So we still had one-dimensional manifolds of solutions to work with. Well, when we perturb the periodic solution, then it's not exactly clear what type, and we want to understand how it can deform or how it can be deformed in the process of singular perturbation. Well, it can deform in many ways. So one of the possibilities here is, of course, to fix the energy of to fix the energy. And to this end, it's easy to. So I'm talking about. So we can apply the same procedure, the same transformation for the periodic solution as for the Hamiltonian solution, and then still there is an integral, the constant of motion in this case, and so one of which is c of epsilon. So one of the way, of course, to say that this, of course, this constant of motion, this is constant with respect to the variable z, but not with respect to epsilon. So one way is to say, well, let's fix this c. Then at least we drop dimension by one. But actually, we don't need to do this. So therefore, we can allow energy also vary as we do the perturbation. Energy also is allowed to vary a little bit. So then for the periodic case, I found out that it's more convenient to work with this third order differential equation, which is a integral of motion of the system. And in the perturbed system, after rescaling, this is how it looks like. So the question is, how do we set the boundary? How do we set the conditions for the problem? Well, we set it in the following way. We want our, so of course the role of the strip from the previous problem now is the quarter of the period of the elliptic function, and the conditions that I set is that I want solution to be an even function with respect to this point. Why do I take this point? Because remember, this is on this line we have singularities. So that if our variables goes along the real axis, we are considering this part of the solution. And when we are going along this line, then we are talking about this part of solution. So I'm interested in perturbation of this part of solution. So therefore, the conditions that that I suggest to set is to require that the function is even at this point. And because it's a third order equation, it's enough to require that the first and the third derivatives are zero, then all other derivatives will be zero automatically, so it will be even with respect to this point. And one more condition, again, because we have this translation invariant, so I require that at this point the derivative is zero, the same way as before. So the theorem says that it is possible, the theorem, this is the paper that I haven't published yet, but it says that if we apply some condition to this energy function, namely, let's require say that this function C of epsilon is continuous, and one more requirement is more restrictive, that it is differentiable at zero and the derivative is zero. That's actually a little bit of a restriction. And then we have the same theorem. Then for any epsilon, there exists a unique solution to this boundary value problem, and moreover, it approaches the solution V plus, the same as before, as epsilon goes to zero uniformly in this square. If this statement is true, we immediately get a corollary that there can be no symmetrical and periodic solution to this perturbed problem if energy stays constant, if we fix the energy, or if we allow energy to vary but sort of say a little bit, because C prime of zero is zero. And it seems that if this state, it's, again, I have to double check this statement, but it seems that if the statement is true, then it cannot rule out completely that the perturbed system does not have symmetrical periodic solution that for small epsilon. But at least if we put epsilon here and these are the periods of possible periodic solution, then the consequence of this theorem will be that the set of omega of periods where the frequency can approach as epsilon goes, where we have periodic solution approaching this period as epsilon goes to zero, this set cannot be dense, because then it will be contradictory to that statement. Well, at this point I would like to finish my talk, and thank you very much for